The Naturalistic Decision-Making Podcast with Brian Moon and Laura Militello. This podcast series brings you interviews with leading NDM researchers who study and support people who make decisions under stress. Welcome to the Naturalistic Decision-Making Podcast. This is Laura Militello from Applied Decision Science.
And I'm Brian Moon from Perigean Technologies.
Today, we're talking with our friend and colleague, Emily Roth. I first met Emily at the second naturalistic decision-making meeting in Dayton, Ohio in 1994, but she had been studying how people manage complexity long before that meeting. In fact, I remember at that meeting thinking, I want to be like her. Emily is one of the people that inspired me to think I really could be a scientist, and I know Emily's inspired many others over the course of her career. She is one of the architects of the cognitive systems engineering movement. She had an important role in redesigning nuclear power plant control rooms in the wake of Three Mile Island, and that was just the beginning. Her contributions have been felt far and wide. She now lives in Palo Alto, California, where she runs Roth Cognitive Engineering. So Emily, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward.
Good. So I wanted to start by going back to the very beginning of your career. And I'm wondering if you can remember the first paper you ever published and tell us something about that.
Oh, sure. So that was when I was back in graduate school in the mid-70s. And I was really studying to be an academic, a cognitive psychologist. And I was interested in reasoning and language, but in very sort of controlled and pure science ways. My first study that I published was my master's. And it's an interesting study because it both reveals my experimental psychology, controlled laboratory sort of roots on the one hand, but also my lasting interest in focusing on what makes people competent and allows them to reveal their competence and their ability to problem solve rather than focusing on biases and errors. And it also, I think, reveals my early interest in not only relying on objective performance, you know, response time and error rates, but also thinking about people's explanations, you know, verbal protocols of why they did what they did. And so this was a very sort of an abstract reasoning task that was well known to cause people to make errors, even, you know, academics and engineers and PhD scientists. And that's called the four card problem. And the idea is you tell people, okay, I've got these four cards and they have a number on one side and a letter on the other side. And I'm going to show you the four cards. And I'm going to give you a rule. And let's say the rule is if there's a 2 on one side, then there's an A on the other side. So we know there's a number on one side and a letter on the other. And so I show you four cards. And the cards have a 2, a B, an A, and a 3. And what you're asked is what cards would you need to turn over to figure out whether this rule is true or not? Well, most people are drawn to come up with a very quick answer that seems obviously correct, but is wrong. So people say, you should choose the 2 because you want to make sure that there's an A on the other side, and they're right about that. But then they say, and you should choose the A. But in fact, what you should do is you should choose the 2, but you should choose the B. And the reason for that is that you choose the 2 because you want to make sure there's an A on the other side, but you choose the B to make sure there isn't a 2 on the other side, right? So there was a 2 and a B, then the rule, if there's a 2, then there's an A, would not be right. And we already knew from prior studies that people are bad at this task. And the question I posed myself is, what can you do to make people understand more quickly what the right answer is? And one solution I came up with was, what if you block the incorrect answer. You know, if you make it impossible for them to give you the answer that's not right, it might cause them to step back and think about it harder. And that's in fact what we did. So we would give them the rule, if there's a 2 on one side, then there's an A on the other side. But then we wouldn't give them, then we'd give them 3 cards, let's say, not 4. We wouldn't give them the 2. That what they'd see is an A, a B, and a 3. And so they couldn't give the obvious answer that would just jump out at them. They had to think about it a little bit. And sure enough, when you do that, people are much more likely to say, oh yeah, you have to check the B, because if you turn the B around and there's a 2, then you know the rule is wrong. In today's parlance, people talk about that as using system 1 versus system 2. So the idea is system 1 is quick and intuitive, but can sometimes be misled. And system 2 is slower and allows you to think things through. And I think in this kind of study, the point was, how do you get people to more naturally realize that they need to use system 2? And so, as I say, I think the study both reflected the fact that, you know, I was doing these very controlled laboratory studies with P levels, et cetera, but that I was also interested in people's competence and what allows them to manifest it. You know, it's in there. It's just them showing it.
So I did not know this about you. This is so interesting. Even when you were doing your master's degree, you were exploring ways to kind of support performance so people do better.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that way at the time, right?
Wow, but that kind of foretold much of the emphasis of your career. That's really cool. So next question. I'm wondering if, so you started out in experimental psychology and were interested in more basic research kind of questions. I'm wondering if you can think of a time or an event or kind of how your career took a turn and you started moving into more naturalistic kinds of studies.
So some of it is I've got to pull back a little bit and maybe just talk about personally what shifted my direction. Some of it was really happenstance. And I got married to my husband, Al Roth, and we were at the University of Illinois. He was a faculty member in the economics department and business school, and I was a graduate student in psychology at the University of Illinois. When I graduated, we needed 2 jobs, and it was a time when it was very hard to get academic jobs in psychology. And 2 jobs made it particularly hard. So we both took a very scary leap. Al had an opportunity to take a position at the University of Pittsburgh, and we knew nothing about Pittsburgh. And I didn't have a job when we arrived in Pittsburgh, but I, you know, applied broadly. And I was just very lucky. The first day I arrived in Pittsburgh, we went to Al's office, and there was a letter for me from Lou Haynes at Westinghouse Science and Technology out in Pittsburgh, offering me an interview. And I ended up, you know, maybe long story, I ended up working at Westinghouse. And so when I got to Westinghouse, I was challenged with very exciting problems. But these were not problems that were amenable to address using traditional experimental design and statistical tools. So a specific example is nuclear power plant operators, Westinghouse built nuclear power plants, often had trouble during startups, starting up the plant. And they would make errors that would lead to plant trips. But there were some expert operators that the plants would always rely on to start up the plant error-free and to do a good job. And so our customer came to us and said, gee, could you figure out how these experts do the task? And we would build an expert system to do the task exactly how they did it. So this is a question that is more exploratory. It's about the basis of expertise. And it seemed natural to go back to first principles about how you do exploratory kinds of studies. And we coupled incident analysis, critical incident analysis. We asked operators who were really good at the task to give us examples of times things went well and times things didn't go well. And we also were lucky we had a simulator. We could bring them into the simulator and observe them perform and observe them talk in the context of actual performance about what it was they did. And that was a much more meaningful way to understand performance. It wouldn't have made any sense to try to, you could have, try to bring the task into a lab environment, but you wouldn't have gotten to the pragmatic expertise. And a crystal example that comes to mind is in the simulator, we had operators and they were having fun with each other, and one was at the reactor side and one was at the secondary side, and they said, "Ho ho, we're going to demonstrate to you how this works." And they said, "Two shrinks is equal to a swell." And that was to indicate that they understood the dynamics of the startup and the dynamics of how water worked, feed water worked during the startup, and that you needed to compensate for shrinks that arise when you're putting in cold water by doing other things that might create a swell, that might create expansion. And so that kind of expertise was best understood through observations and interviews and best dealt with through better training and better displays rather than trying to build an expert system to replace performance.
So I'm curious, was there an expectation that you would do more experimental sorts of things and you had to kind of find your way to these other methods, or were you already familiar with interview strategies and observation and that sort
of thing? So I'm trying to think because, I did come from Pittsburgh, and I know you spent time in Pittsburgh as well, and that was, I was in Pittsburgh for at Westinghouse, and that was the time when Herb Simon was doing a lot of protocol analysis and kinds of studies, and so it was in the air, and I think, I think there was starting to be understanding about careful observations and verbal protocols and critical incidents. And of course, it was also a time when we were uncovering some of our close colleagues who were simultaneously, I think, inventing tools and methods like Gary Klein and Robert Hoffman.
Nice. So one more follow-up about that. So the question they posed was, can you create an expert system that would be able to do what these really experienced humans can do? How did that work out?
So this was work done in collaboration with Dave Woods and actually some control theory guys as well. John Gallagher was involved we actually use multiple approaches. We actually created visualizations that allowed people to perform the task in better ways. So I think among the things that we learned from this is sure, we could have built an expert system that told the operator, okay, if you're in this situation, two shrinks equals a swell, so tap twice on the feed water and then at the same time increase reactor level by a certain amount. You could try to do that, but that's sort of like trying to teach someone to drive a car by saying to them, move the steering wheel to the right three times, then move the steering wheel to the left two times. It's just not doesn't make any sense. So instead, what we did was reimagine the task, create new visualizations that allowed people to see directly how to do the task smoothly. So they didn't have to memorize these strategies for making visible what was invisible. We actually created visualizations that allowed them to do the task more smoothly.
Wow. Yeah. So you're saying this in such a matter-of-fact way, but I happen to know this was really groundbreaking work that wasn't what people were expecting. That wasn't the outcome people were expecting, and it was a really powerful and impactful outcome. So that's a really cool story, cool experience.
So Emily, you're also using these terms, shrinks and swells and feed water, as if the rest of us know what that stuff is.
Sure, sorry.
I will say actually that I do know what some of that stuff is. I also had a Westinghouse project around 2010, went on for about 3 years in more of a knowledge management aspect. Yeah. So some of these folks that you may very well have worked with nearing the end of their career in Westinghouse at the time was going through a bit of a resurgence with new plants and in the U.S. and China. And so they were really interested in how can we get some of that expertise out of the heads of folks who are going to be leaving and into the heads of all these fresh-faced engineers. And so that was my sort of experience with Westinghouse. But I'm as you're mentioning these terms, I'm sort of thinking back and remembering how challenging it was in that project to simultaneously try to execute cognitive task analysis methods and start to understand how a nuclear power plant works, right? So that domain is incredibly complex. And so I'm wondering, I have a general question sort of about, you know, barriers in terms of things that you've had to overcome that might have been more difficult than you expected in your career, but I'm specifically interested in your very earliest days there at Westinghouse, as you're trying to understand what this whole domain is about, did you feel that was a particular challenge in just trying to understand, you know, the ins and outs of a nuclear power plant?
You know, absolutely. You know, there was a serious learning curve. On the other hand, I was very lucky to be working as part of teams that brought that expertise to bear. So again, early in my career when I arrived at Westinghouse, Dave Woods was already there, and he already had started along these lines of research. And we had we aligned ourselves with engineers from the nuclear energy group, including Bill Elm and John Gallagher and Jim Easter, who were very patient in explaining to us nuclear power plant operations. And in turn, we could translate that into psychological notions of people having wrong mental models, or how you could bring visualizations to make clearer what was going on in the dynamic process. But the other thing that it raises is another sort of core formative element for me when I hit Westinghouse was the emphasis on really understanding the domain and what makes it hard. And so we did work very closely with people like John Gallagher and Bill Elm to develop work domain analyses, to sort of understand the dynamics of these processes and what parameters were being controlled and what information was available about those parameters in the control room. And the answer is not enough. That information wasn't available because at low levels, the sensors didn't provide sufficient guidance. We needed to simultaneously use what we call cognitive work analysis, domain analysis, to really come up with a map of what information you really do need to solve these problems, together with the psychology, understanding people's mental models, their strategies, and what allows them to perform successfully.
So the tools were helpful, as well as the other people were helpful in sort of overcoming that particular barrier. I'm wondering if as you think back over your career, are there other barriers that you experienced that were more difficult to overcome than you might have expected?
You know, I'm thinking hard about that question, and ironically, I feel very lucky in my career, in that I was a young female psychologist in a world that mostly I was dealing with male engineers, and you could imagine that I would have difficulty both because of my gender and because, you know, I'm a sort of soft, more soft qual rather than a quant, right? But in fact, I didn't experience that at all. When I hit Westinghouse, they were very supportive people that helped me advance through the system, like Dave Woods and my boss, Lou Haynes, who was an amazing boss. And there were engineers that respected the knowledge I was bringing to bear with respect to psychology and human-computer interaction. And they were quite thirsty for that kind of knowledge. And so it definitely felt collaborative that they were teaching me nuclear power, and I was explaining to them about natural language understanding and mental models and how you need to observe people as well as have them talk through things. So it was, I think there was mutual respect.
Yeah, that's great. I can think of a similar sort of perspective as I was at Westinghouse, and that's kind of built into their culture, right? With their consulting engineer levels, you know, folks who have a lot of experience there are expected to be mentors and expected to sort of guide people. So it's a really interesting sort of organizational culture to be involved in.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I actually, I haven't experienced many other corporate environments. So I don't know how different they were, but Westinghouse at that time, and especially Westinghouse nuclear power folks, were just, you know, amazing people, just the way you said.
What a great start, a great first job.
I agree.
Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. I know you have worked with the railways, and trains certainly have, you know, some romance to a lot of people, but to a passenger, driving a train seems pretty straightforward. So I wondered if you could tell us about some of the interesting insights you've learned working with railway engineers and conductors and those sorts of folks.
Yep. That's been a fun strand of research as well. And, one of the interesting things for me early on when I started to work in the railroad industry relative to the nuclear industry is that in the nuclear industry, people spent a lot of time concerned about risk and concerned about safety. But in fact, while there's low probability risks that we're trying to manage of core meltdown and accidents, there really are very few fatalities, very few accidents or people getting hurt. Whereas in railroads, that's much less the case. So roadway workers are constantly at risk, including at risk of being hit by trains, especially if the trains aren't, if they're not looking, you know, if they're looking down at the rail and they weren't expecting a train, or the train wasn't supposed to be coming by at that time or in that direction, people can get hurt. And so one of the things that we observed, both through our interviews, but more importantly, actually, through actual observation, you're actually riding on trains and riding on rail cars with roadway workers, is that everyone spends a lot of time worrying about each other and giving each other heads up to avoid these kinds of unexpected situations that might create problems. So dispatchers, whose job it is to, you know, route trains and assign roadway workers to work in areas, will alert roadway workers if they're going to be scheduling a train that they hadn't otherwise anticipated. And if a train comes by and sees a train going in the other direction and had just seen some roadway workers earlier, he'll call the roadway workers on the radio and alert them that the train is coming, and alert the other train that there are roadway workers on the track. And these are not formal processes. They're not trained to do this. They're not formally expected to do this. And when you point out that they're doing this, they would say to me, these are courtesies. You know, the term they use for this kind of behavior is they're courtesies. But in fact, what they are is informal strategies that aren't documented, but that are promulgated throughout the organization that increase the resilience of the organization, increase safety, and increase productivity as well. So I think that collaborative nature and that emergent behavior was one of the striking things I learned in that industry.
That is so interesting. So it sounds like some of the things that make that organization resilient are completely not part of procedures in any way. They're thinking of them as courtesies.
Exactly. And I was going to say even the use of that language to signal that I don't really have to do this. I'm not being asked to do this, but it's an important thing to do.
Yeah. So how does an organization support that kind of behavior?
Right. So I think this is an interesting question because it's not a question that has been sufficiently pursued, because what is interesting to me is that since it isn't taught, it isn't formally covered in courses, the question is how does it promulgate through the system and how does it continue to be supported? And frankly, as a workload increases, these strategies may be some of the first ones that are vulnerable because they are discretionary. So one of the conclusions we drew from our work is the importance of, documenting these strategies and highlighting their importance so that they are either directly supported, or if they can't be directly supported, then you create, you provide the same service in another way, maybe automatic alerts or messages but
so this is such an important insight. So these informal things that increase the safety of the system are likely to be things that are shed when workload gets too high. And so just uncovering those kind of almost invisible things that make such a big difference and bring them to people's attention feels like such an important contribution there.
Yeah. It was certainly interesting. Yeah.
Okay. So we've been kind of reflecting a lot. If we kind of think about current days and looking forward, what are some of the NDM related research directions that you're most excited about now?
Okay. So, I think what's most impressive to me about NDM right now is how healthy it is and how accepted it is across a variety of domains. You know, there was recently the NDM conference out here in San Francisco, and there's the book that was just published, The Oxford Handbook of Expertise, that really showcases all the different areas that NDM is actively involved in. So healthcare, sports, cybersecurity, you name it. People understand the value of understanding, decision making in the real world and trying to, document it and support it. So that's one thing that I think is exciting. But another thing that I think is an interesting new challenge that Laura, you and I have had the opportunity to work on is to apply NDM techniques, the critical decision interview method, among others, to try and inform the envisioned world. So there are lots of new systems that are being developed, you know, all the way from self-driving cars to aircraft that are used almost as taxis, to envisioned unmanned vehicles of various sorts. And we don't have a handle on how people are going to operate in this new world, this envisioned world. And so you and I and the ADS team had an opportunity to face that challenge head on in the context of trying to think about a world in which a new kind of helicopter, a next generation army helicopter, is likely to operate, where both the world is likely to be more dangerous with enemies that are near peer, but also the likelihood that there's much more automation, a variety of UAS that are operating on their own and intelligently. And the question is, what's the role of the human in those situations, and what's likely to be challenging? And so we had the opportunity to see how we can use NDM techniques to support an understanding of the envisioned world. Our work there involved trying to study surrogate organizations. You know, we don't know the details of how a pilot is going to deal with next generation helicopters, because they're not built yet and the world doesn't exist. But there are some analogs that can help us understand the likely challenges and extrapolate the challenges. And so we did that. We interviewed Kiowa operators and Apache operators and other kinds of specialists to get a chance to understand both what's already hard in the world, in today's world, what's likely to be harder, and what kind of knowledge and expertise humans bring to the party that we want to make sure is preserved in the envisioned world. So there are some things that we know are going to be challenging for automation that people do well today and that are likely to be needed in the future as well. Using NDM techniques to get at that is, I think, turned out to be quite valuable.
Yeah, that's been great, great work. And it's been really fun to work together on it. I wanted to just kind of reflect on your response. You started out saying that NDM is healthy and accepted. And I'm thinking, even over the course of my career, I feel like when I started out, we were thinking, there were lots of questions about whether cognitive task analysis is a legitimate method and interviews and observations, does that really count? And if you fast forward to this project we just worked on, no one was asking those kind of questions. We were asking, how can we combine cognitive task analysis and work domain analysis and imprint modeling and all these different kinds of tools? How can we kind of adapt them and leverage them and combine them in interesting ways to answer these novel questions? So the NDM community really has come a long way.
Yeah. No, that's really exciting. Yeah.
So Emily, you've been very generous with your work over the years and mentoring lots of folks, and I think lots of folks know a bit about you and certainly through your work. But I'm wondering, is there anything? Let's give you two things. Tell us two things about you that the audience probably doesn't know.
Oh, okay. okay. Let's see. So I think things that are outside of my, sort of professional persona that are valuable and important to me. One of them, I think, is how I really love to entertain, and I really love to cook, to cook for lots of guests. And that turned out to be, I think, a very rewarding aspect of my life, in that it helps to bring a sense of community to people around me. And I don't necessarily cook fancy, but bringing people together has turned out to be important for me, and people have given me feedback that it's helped help them be part of the community. So that's a part of my sense of self that may be a little different. And then the other part, I suppose another thing that people may not fully know about me is that while I champion qualitative methods and observations and interviews, my family, I'm surrounded by quants. my husband is an economist that uses mathematical tools. My older son, Aaron, is a computer scientist that uses mathematical tools. My younger son, Ben, is an economist, a different kind of economist. He's a development economist. He's interested in how to support people in countries that are poorer. But he also brings mathematical tools to bear. And their wives are all quads. So my Aaron's wife, Kathy, is a PhD mathematician who works as a software engineer. And my other daughter-in-law, Stephanie, is a PhD economist who works at a startup, but in very mathematical ways. But we all, all respect each other, and I think that all the work is exciting.
And so you can use the food to avoid those debates at the dinner table. Is that the plan?
Exactly.
Great strategy.
Yeah. And as someone who has been lucky enough to be at some of your dinner parties, they are fun, and you do such a nice job of bringing together scientists and physicians and, just all kinds of people who have, who can learn from each other and just enjoy a really nice casual meal. So,
yeah. And vice versa. I remember nice gatherings at your own place.
Thanks. So I think the last question here on the list is, I'm wondering if you could tell us about two or three books maybe outside of the NDM literature that have influenced your thinking.
Okay. Sure. So I think there's one book that particularly influenced my thinking and also reassured me relative to our own work as human factors scientists and people struggling with design of systems for people, the design of first-of-a-kind systems. And that's a book that was written in 1982 by an engineer that's called To Engineer as Human, The Role of Failure in Successful Design. And it was written by Henry Petrosky. And he basically is a storyteller, and he tells many stories about how really even engineering design is experimental and it's trial and error. And we think about, we think that engineers have, straightforward formulas for how to create something and they just do simple math. But that turns out to work better for well-understood systems. If you already know how to build an elevator, then the next, the second elevator and the third elevator are pretty routine, and you can just apply formulas and do okay. But when you're building the first of a kind, the first one, it's definitely an envisioning process. It's a trial and error process, and accidents happen before you finally develop robust systems that you can apply again and again. And an example that he uses is suspension bridges. There are now beautiful and robust suspension bridges like the iconic Brooklyn Bridge. that are wonderful, and no one worries about them falling down. But the first suspension bridges that were built over rivers did fall down, and it was a trial and error process. And so a little bit, I feel, you know, we shouldn't beat ourselves for the fact that whenever we find ourselves designing a new system, we fall back on, well, we're going to have to do an evaluation, or, you know, we'll need to put it in place and continue to get feedback on how well it's working and modify it. That's just how the design process of first-of-a-kind systems work. So that's one book. And I could give you a different book, which is very different.
Yeah, I mean, the one you just mentioned, I'm not familiar with that one at all, but that sounds very interesting. And
that's one I think I recommend. It just really stood out.
Well, and it's such an important perspective because often the sponsor is hoping you're going to get it right the first time and has an expectation that you'll be able to tell them exactly when it will be ready and right.
Exactly. So the second book is really very different. And I just picked a recent book that sort of really impressed me. I really enjoy reading memoirs and stories about real people and their struggles and how they've overcome the struggles, and especially books about women. And there's a recent book that was written in 2019 by Stephanie Land, which is very highly readable and highly thought-provoking. And it's called Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. And it's really about her own experience and precariousness. She had been planning to go on to college, but ran into financial troubles and eventually became homeless. And she had a young child. And she took on, you know, many different kinds of jobs. And she eventually got herself on her feet and applied for and got financial support to go to college. And so it was a success story in that sense. But it really brought home the precarious financial situations that people can find themselves in and how they can very rapidly, without any fault of their own, find themselves homeless. And how hard it is to come up with the knowledge and maybe even more importantly, the time that you need to invest to get yourself out of those situations, to obtain the governmental and non-governmental support you need to get back on your feet. And in her case, you know, she eventually figured out, and she describes in gory detail all the paperwork that was involved in getting financial support to go to college, and how uphill struggle it was, and how it required concerted attention and considerable, you know, mental workload devoted to that, and which you may not have the luxury to have when you're in those kinds of situations.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know that book either, but I definitely want to check it out. Great. Okay, so the last part I have here, this is an associative thinking exercise. So I am going to read a word, and I'm going to ask you to just say the first thing that comes to mind. Your answer should be three words or less. And then when we get to the end of the list, if there are any you want to return to and give follow-up or more explanation, you can pick one. Okay?
Okay.
All right. You ready? Okay. The first one is autonomy.
Autonomy. Brittleness.
Oh, no, that's great. Okay. How about nuclear power?
Robustness. Yeah.
Okay. Working from home.
Luxury, especially.
Scenario.
Fundamental.
Expertise.
Difficult to access.
Okay. Trade-offs.
Ooh. Can I use fundamental sure. again? Inherent.
Inherent. Okay.
Inherent.
Collaboration.
Critical.
And table tennis.
So important for family development.
Great. How's that? That was fun. Are there any you want to elaborate on?
Maybe the first one, automation, where I came back with brittleness. And that's a tough one because automation is important. It's how we advance. Cars used to have manual transmission, and now people only use manual transmission for sport, right? Because they enjoy it. And so automation is important and valuable, and it allows people to do more than they were able to do before. So it's a very positive thing. On the other hand, designers and engineers are classically overconfident, and that's why scenarios are important. It's too easy to think about all the ways mm-hmm. things can go right, and not enough about how things can go wrong. So that's where to engineer as human was important to me. So in our work, and I know Laura in your work as well, we think very hard about the role of the human in adding to the resilience of the system. So we're not anti-automation, but we're trying to be cautious about how to introduce automation and how to make sure people can understand the automation and contribute to more resilient joint performance.
Well said. I completely agree. Well, thank you, Emily, for speaking with us today. This has been really fun.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun. It was nice to speak to you and Brian.
So on that note, I want to thank you for joining us for the NDM podcast. I'm Laura Militello.
And I'm Brian Moon. Learn more about naturalistic decision making and where to follow us by visiting naturalisticdecisionmaking.org.